welcome to session 5402, A Big Beautiful Wall, a discussion of U.S. immigration policy. So quick announcement, in this session we will utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, simply select the session in the schedule, tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You may also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers around here. You must write legibly, or else I can't read it. If you are a student or attending remotely, please note this in your question. Mark your question. Make your questions brief and to the point. Thank you. Look forward to seeing the questions that come in here. My name is Lee Shanis. I'm your moderator. I run a nonprofit organization in town called Intercambio. Who knows Intercambio? Oh, wow. All right. Nice. So Intercambio, yeah, that's good. Intercambio is breaking down walls, not physical walls, but walls that are created because of language and cultural barriers here. We have about 500 volunteers a year who are teaching English to adult immigrants and creating new connections and everyone gaining new perspectives. If you're interested in learning more, coming to an information session, I've got some cards. Come talk to me after the show. But this is about these folks today. So before we start the panel, we have a touch artist who's going to briefly share with you what she's going to do here. And she also has done 90 to 100 drawings already this week that are out in the white tent area if you want to go check those out after the panel. So
hi,
Deborah, welcome.
Hi. This is kind of low on the floor, but I just want to show you what I will be doing throughout. It's a process called touch drawing, and I'll be drawing with my fingertips. And what I'll be doing, it's a very direct and fast way to create images. And I'm going to be listening to the content. So people think I'm sketching. I'm not drawing the presenters. I'm listening to the content, and I'm translating it in a poetic and artistic way. So it's also not like illustrating the thoughts. I'm traveling along, and I think you're all creating images and associations as you listen. And what I'm doing is making that visible. And now I'm going to do one drawing for you. And I have a wonderful assistant. This is going to be his next job. We've agreed.
This is my retirement gig.
Just so I can... So this is a board. It's got ink on it that I've rolled out. And I'm putting paper down. And I'm going to touch the paper with my fingertips. So everywhere that I'm touching, the pressure is picking up paint on the other side. And it'll take me about a minute. I'm going to do a nice fast one for you. I work a little more slowly during the sessions, but I do a whole series of drawings as I'm listening. So it's not a singular. This is really about entering a process and kind of deepening as you go. And what I'm doing right now is I've chosen to draw a face with two hands, and I'm finding it kind of interesting. I knew I was going to draw a face, but I never really know what it's going to look like. And I'm going to lift it up in just a moment so you can see.
Drum roll.
Okay.
Whoa. Wow.
I didn't know I'm that handsome.
Nice. Thank you.
Well done.
So, yeah, if you want to see more of her art, there's a bunch of those outside. Okay. We're going to have some brief opening statements by our three speakers, and then we've got plenty of time for questions and answers. You can submit those anytime. First up is Maya. Maya is a freelance reporter based in Mexico City. She's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post. She covers asylum and immigration, including the recent policies around the people migrating from Central America. She's reported on the caravans, knows a lot about this topic. So please give a warm welcome for Maya Auerbach.
Thanks for having me. I'm Maya. So I'm going to talk a little bit about mostly the contemporary situation around the wall, because that's what I cover. I will say the discussion over sort of where the U.S. border lies and exactly how much it should be restricted is obviously a longstanding one. And if you look back more than a century, you can find efforts to limit illegal immigration across that border, be they because the U.S. is trying to keep out convicts or prostitutes or anarchists or polygamists or whoever it deems unacceptable. And yet a lot of the discussion around the wall itself and how many billion dollars should be spent to build it across the U.S.-Mexico border is also quite recent. It was not so long ago that we spoke of the wall as a fence, and you can also go to parts of the border and see the places where it's already been built. And really what happened in the sort of 90s and early 2000s, also with the efforts to limit immigration in a physical sense across that border, was that we did see a decline in, let's say, immigration from Mexico, but also a restriction to the type of immigration that can happen that made it all the more dangerous for people who were trying to get to the U.S. who had no other means to get to the country. So if you go now to the Arizona desert, you can see search groups who continue to go every month to find bodies in that area of people who, because it was difficult to cross in other areas, because things like seasonal migration where people could go back and forth across the border were increasingly restricted over concerns over illegal immigration, the people ended up going to more remote areas, depending on smugglers, putting themselves more at risk in efforts to get to the U.S. And to stay there or to go temporarily. And that's a longstanding problem now. What are the issues that the wall has been said to try to address? One would be the passage of drugs across the border, though we know that most drugs come through ports of entry, and we know that that is a problem that we can try to address. We can try to address issues of corruption. We can try to talk about the technology that organized crime groups use. We can try to figure out what their routes are. But if it is true that most drugs come through ports of entry, then we have to ask what is the benefit of trying to build a wall. The other issue that's much discussed is immigration, but who's the group of people who have most made headlines and now form a major part of those who are coming to the country are asylum seekers coming from Central America. That's not to say that all Central Americans now are asylum seekers. It's not to say also that all individuals who apply for asylum will eventually be granted asylum, but that is to say that we see a sort of major shift in who's coming now and compared comparison to 15 years ago, let's say, that in the last 5 years especially, you've seen an increase in the number of Central Americans and people from other countries who are doing one of two things. A smaller number of people are going to ports of entry, that means like the legal entry points to the U.S., and asking for asylum in whatever terms they may do that. They may ask not to be returned to their home countries. They may ask just for help and be put into asylum processes. And then we're seeing another group of people who either cross in areas where there is no wall, or cross over the wall, or cross under the wall, or go through the wall, whatever means they can find, and then find a Border Patrol official and hand themselves in. And they are crossing unauthorized, but in the moment that they are on U.S. soil and asking for asylum, within their rights to ask for protection. Because the U.S. government, you know, is a signer to an international protocol and has its own immigration laws that say that it cannot return someone to the country they are fleeing from if their life or freedom is at risk. And there are specific requirements within that about exactly who should be protected, if it's people who are being persecuted or likely to be persecuted on account of their race or religion or their nationality, their political opinion, their membership in a particular social group, which excludes many of the people who might want to find a way to get to the U.S. And yet, if this is the case, there are scenes on the border now where Border Patrol officials stand at the border and watch hundreds of people cross the border wall and hand themselves in, then what is the point of expanding it? And so fundamentally, I think the U.S. is in a moment where the wall is a symbolic question. It's one about the extent to which the U.S. is going to allow immigration, the extent to which it's going to force people to take legal pathways, whether or not those exist for them, right? Because the number of temporary visas that exist for high-skilled and low-skilled labor, as it's termed, fluctuate over time. Refugees programs have been cut drastically, such that the refugee limit per year now under the Trump administration is 30,000 people, far lower than it used to be before. Not that it was that high before. Previously it was 85,000 people, I think, at the end of the Obama administration. And so many people who might be seeking to this country don't necessarily find themselves with the legal route, which is why they can then, I won't say, you know, the government would say take advantage of the existing laws or game the system. But you could also say that migration is adapting to fit the existing laws, the fact that the U.S. is a country with asylum laws. And so at the point that they're on U.S. soil, they cannot be immediately sent back if they're seeking help. The other thing that I will note that is an interesting point around the discussion around who is undocumented in this country is that most undocumented immigrants do not come through the U.S.-Mexico border. Most of them overstay visas, whether those visas are for business or for education or for conferences like this one. And so that's another question at hand, right? If the U.S. is so concerned about the undocumented population in this country, why is it that that concern is mostly directed towards the most visible form of migration, right? It's directed towards the border because that's where you can have video footage, that's where you can see it, but that's also where there's a sort of symbolic debate over what does America stand for and where are its values. And that's much harder to do when you have someone who came and maybe was a student here and then overstayed and then has a job and then eventually finds a legal pathway to staying in this country. But as we continue to debate whether there will be billions of dollars spent on the wall, I think it is important to ask those questions then. What would it serve? Would it limit immigration? Would it limit the amount of drugs coming over the border? Is it just, you know, meant to be a symbol of American power? And you can argue maybe America just needs symbols of American power being built all over the place. But that is a question. What is the purpose it would serve? Can those billions of dollars be spent elsewhere to address some of these issues that the American electorate seems so preoccupied by? And so my perspective, again, is from someone who sometimes works along the U.S.-Mexico border, sometimes works along the Mexico-Guatemala border, which doesn't have a wall. You can kind of float across it on a raft. It's not to say that Mexico doesn't stop many, many immigrants, thousands of immigrants every year who are coming through, but it has a different processes for doing so, dependent more on Mexican authorities blocking major highway routes. And again, they have their own immigration system to try to limit who comes into their country and who gets to stay. And so while we are starting this lovely discussion with all of these people who I think will share different aspects of the border with you, I would, you know, bear those major questions in mind of, is a physical barrier really the way to resolve some of the issues at hand? And if migration also is at a low relative to, say, the late 90s or 2000, but increasingly on the U.S.-Mexico border, formed part by asylum seekers, how can the system adapt to address that?
Thank you, Maya. All right, up next is a professor and former chair of the Department of Economics at St. Michael's College in Vermont. He's a native of Tehran, Iran, where he graduated with a BA in economics. He received his MA and PhD from the University of Colorado Boulder.
Go Buffs!
Please give a warm welcome to Reza Ramazani.
Let me begin by saying,
It's wonderful to be back to this wonderful city and a great university. And I am an old timer. I've been doing this for the past few years. I lost track. But it's amazing. It's wonderful to see so many of you. And it's Saturday afternoon to come to listen to us. On behalf of my colleagues, we are very grateful to you. Both in terms of, you know, I'm amazed not on in terms of quantity, number of people, but the quality, the type of a question you folks are asking. So when I go back to Vermont, I'm very hopeful, you know, that this country is going to be a good place for me, for my daughter, and hopefully for my grandchildren. Now, I was on a panel similar to this, the immigration, and I think this is an emotional and sensitive issue for me. Same as the rest of you, if not all of you, I'm an immigrant. I left Iran in 1977. I know a lot of people make fun of economists, but I'm a special economist. I'm in the position of a crystal ball. In 1977, I look at my crystal ball, and I knew the mullahs were coming. So I decided that's the time for me to run from Iran. And the same as many students, I came here, the idea was to get an advanced degree and go back and become a productive member of Iranian society. Especially growing up in a very poor family in Iran, I want to be a role model. I want to go home and tell people like myself, if you have a work ethic, if you work hard, you're going to make it. I probably was young, cocky, whatever you want to call it. But what I want to ask you folks, this is the same as the face of an immigrant. And I'm asking you sometimes, it doesn't matter legal or undocumented, sometimes as an immigrant, we might not have a choice. We might not have a choice. I am so grateful to this country. I do not want to leave any place else than United States, to be very honest with you. This is my home. This country has been good to me. But I got to be very honest with you. It's a two-way street. I have been good to this country too. That's the reason I have high expectation, my fellow immigrant. To be very honest with you, I have high expectation. Because I don't want any of us, documented or undocumented, to do anything bad in order to throw a red meat at few people, to use one or two cases and generalize, and as I'm sure you have seen, scapegoating us for everything is wrong or everything wrong, every wrong thing happened in this country. So for example, if one immigrant has committed a crime, raping someone or doing something, some people or few people have a tendency to say, look, I told you this is what undocumented or documented people do, that the reason we need to impose restriction. And I think it's a very emotional issue, and I totally understand that the reason some people or a few people play with American emotion and generalize few problems we have with immigration, both legal or documented one. Now, the argument for, against immigration has nothing to do, honest to God, with economics. It's political, it's cultural, and social issues. Because a study after a study indicates that the net effect of immigration, again, when you look at both legal, and I don't like to call it illegal or undocumented, has a positive effect on the U.S. economy. Be very honest with you, except in some communities when we have a large population of uneducated and low-skilled immigrant, there is a net loss, and the data is there. The net loss is $1,600 per immigrant for that community is mainly because of the amount of money we spend to educate their children. But overall, the fact has been very positive. And then I want to make the following statements. We have to be realistic. You might not like people like me as an immigrant. And I understand sometimes the resentment. I don't complain. I accept it as a part of a reality, part of the cost I have to pay to live in this wonderful country. I don't complain. I understand it. But I want to ask you guys, you have to look at the facts. There is no other choice. Look at what is happening to the population of the United States. For better or worse, we are getting old. And we are not, honest to God, having as many children as in the past. In the past, when Americans have more children, immigrants was a reinforcement. But today, because Americans do not have as many children, immigrant becomes as a replacement, and that probably causes resentment. But look, folks, who are the people in construction industry? Who are the people are picking up your fruit and vegetables? In hospitality industry, who is preparing your food? Let's also look at closer example. My dad was a gardener, and after revolution, during the hostage situation, the only way I was able to survive by doing some gardening for a very wealthy people, you know, in Boulder and also Denver area. Now, who is taking care of babies in this country? Who is taking care of older people? Who is taking care of your house, coming to your beautiful house and clean your house? Who is doing the yard work? Who is doing the landscaping? So the question is, first of all, we don't have enough Americans to do those work for us. Let me talk about the example in the state of Vermont. Let me talk about the dairy industry. First of all, we don't have enough people to do the job. And if we have American that they want to do the job, it's a dirty job, it's a tough job, it's almost 24/7. You have to get up 3 o'clock in the morning in the middle of the winter when the temperature is minus 20. You got to go milk those cows, and those cows are going to poop all over you. So it's dirty, hard job. And if we find few Americans, to be very honest, that they want to do the job, you think they want to do it at the same wages? Absolutely not. They want to work 5 days a week. They want their retirement. They want livable wage, whatever. God knows what the livable wage means these days. But if you are willing to pay for it, I have no problem. But you have to consider what will happen to the cost of food, the cost of the thing. So very quickly, this is another thing I think my colleague mentioned. This is, I think, is very important. I have no problem building a beautiful wall, like the wall of China, to attract a lot of tourists. This is beautiful. Especially, I'm an economist. I like free stuff. Especially, somebody else is going to pay for it. I have no complaint. Let's build it all over the place. And it become a major attraction, tourist attraction for people. We can generate a lot of revenue. Now, border security or border wall is seriously distort our understanding about the immigration. My colleague was absolutely correct. Recently, most of the undocumented are people who came to this country legally, students and tourists, and overstay their visa. And one more statement. As an economist, the first thing I teach my kids, my students, about the limitation and the scarcity. We have limited resources, so we cannot have an open border. And I think this is a very important question. We got to make a decision about the immigration. Our system is broken. By building wall, we are not going to fix it. So we got to come up with what we want with immigration. How many immigrants do we want and what kind? I think that's the issue. Maybe we can discuss it more during the question and answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Reza. That was exactly 6 minutes, like you said.
Very good. That's a miracle for a college professor.
Up next, we've got John Eastman. He is the former dean at Chapman University's Daley Fowler School of Law. He's appeared as an expert legal commentator on television and radio, including C-SPAN, Fox News, NPR, and PBS NewsHour. Please give a warm welcome for John Eastman.
Very good, John.
Our moderator's tone suggests we ought to try and make this into a Saturday night wrestling fight, so let me see if I can accommodate.
Interesting.
Lots of agreement so far. I agree with both of my colleagues that the border wall has become largely a symbol of larger fight over immigration policy. Largely, not exclusively. I also agree that illegal immigration across the border is not the only and not even the primary source of illegal immigration in the country. People overstaying H-1B visas or other work visas or tourist visas where they need tourist visas to come or student visas are also part of the problem. But that doesn't mean that we ought not to address the border crisis if there is one in immigration. And I'm going to begin kind of looking back over maybe a half century or so of kind of our thinking on immigration policy. Here's a statement from Barbara Jordan, 1995 chairman of the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform, leading prominent Democrat in Congress. It is a right and a responsibility of a democratic society to manage immigration so that it serves the national interest. Here's another statement from the roughly the same time, and I'll let you try and figure out, was this President Bush 41 or was this President Clinton? All Americans are rightly disturbed by the large numbers of illegal aliens entering our country. We are a nation of immigrants, but also a nation of laws. It is wrong for a nation of immigrants to permit the kind of abuse of our immigration laws we have seen in recent years, and we must do more to stop it. Bush or Clinton? Clinton, 1995 State of the Union Address. Here's another one. Tell me, is this President Obama or President Trump? We cannot continue to allow people to enter the U.S. undetected, undocumented, and unchecked. The American people are a welcoming and generous people, but those who enter our country's border illegally and those who employ them disrespect the rule of law. We need to secure our borders and support additional personnel, infrastructure, and technology on the border and at our points of entry. More agents, better technology, dismantle the human trafficking organizations, etc. Obama or Trump?
Obama.
Obama. It was the 2008 platform of the Democrat Party and frequently repeated by President Obama on the campaign trail. As late as 2010, in the Gallup poll, they've been asking the same question for years. Do you favor or oppose building a wall along the border with Mexico? As late as 2010, 50% of Democrats answered that question, yes, I favor building a border wall. So what's happened in the last 8 years? Well, cynically, we might say it's Trump, and anything Trump wants to do, we're going to oppose, right? Or less cynically, there's been a transformation, particularly on the Democrat side of our political spectrum, about immigration generally. The law hasn't changed. The law hasn't changed, and this is important, and I want to go back to Barbara Jordan's comments, responsibility of a democratic society to manage immigration. We also have a very constitutionally defined allocation of who has the responsibility for making those policy judgments. It's Congress who's given the plenary power over naturalization and immigration policy. Now, we may disagree with the balance that Congress has struck, but one of the things that's been most interesting about the debates over the last decade or two on immigration is relatively little attention paid to what the law actually says right now, and the discussion over illegal immigration is largely a discussion of whether we're going to ignore the laws on the books and effectively let other people, other nations, define what our immigration policy ought to be, or whether we're going to continue to have the policy making judgment assigned to where Constitution puts it, which is in Congress. Now let me talk about about the most controversial of these, and this is President Trump's insistence on a border wall. Let's also put that in context. He's asked for $5.7 billion. Earlier on he asked for $8 billion. In the context of our national budget, that's less than 0.2% of the $4 trillion budget. 0.2%. In fact, just a few years ago, Democrats were supporting a lot larger allocation of budget for a border wall. In 2006, Congress passed overwhelmingly the Secure Fencing Act of 2006. It included a majority of Democrats voting for it, including people like Chuck Schumer, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama in the U.S. Senate. That law required the building of 700 plus miles of border fence or border wall, and it's already been authorized. About half of that was completed. Another nearly half of it is vehicle fencing only, which does not stop pedestrian traffic at all. It's just post rather than a fence. President Trump already has the authority to allocate funds to complete that border wall or improve that border wall. There's been a lot of talk about his declaration of a national emergency, completely outside his authority to do it. Not so. It's very specifically statutorily authorized. It's Section 201 of the National Emergencies Act of 1976. For those that want to actually look it up, it's in Title 50 of the U.S. Code, Section 1621. The first time that statute was used was by President Carter after the takeover of the Tehran of the embassy in Iran. But President Carter's declaration of a national emergency on the hostage takeover has been renewed every year by every president since because of the other statutory authorities that get triggered when there's a declaration of a national emergency. Several of those statutes are directly applicable to President Trump's wish to build a wall. Whether we agree with it as good policy or not, he clearly has a statutory authority to do this. For example, Title 33 of the U.S. Code, Section 2293, allows for the reallocation of any existing military construction project if the president determines it's necessary for the national defense, as long as the emergency requires or may require the use of armed forces. Now, President Obama, President Bush, President Clinton, and the first President Bush all used U.S. armed forces to deal with incursions on our southern border. So this is not anything new. Another statute, Section 2808 of Title 10, isn't even limited to previously authorized projects. The Secretary of Defense can undertake military construction for projects not otherwise authorized by law if they deem it's necessary to support the use for which the armed forces are being deployed. And it specifically includes border security efforts. Section 404 of the 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act allows for the declaration of an immigration emergency fund. An immigration emergency to deal with border security issues anytime the president determines that our immigration forces are outnumbered or overwhelmed by what's happening at the border. And finally, there's Section 284 of Title 10. Which does not even require a declaration of a national emergency. That statute authorizes the Secretary of Defense to provide support to any federal or state agency, local agency, or tribal government for counter-drug activities, specifically including, quote, construction of roads and fences to block drug smuggling corridors across international borders. So all of those statutory authorities are already there. Now, we may not wish they were there, or we may think that Congress delegated too much policy judgment making to the president in the United States. And I'd be happy to see a court strike down what the president has done here, saying we're going to revive what I call the non-delegation doctrine in the Constitution. Lawmaking judgments have to be made by Congress, not by executive agencies. If we want to revive that, great. I think it's a good originalist constitutional perspective. But the one thing we can't tolerate is to say the delegation of power to the president by all of these statutes can be deployed by President Obama as it was, by President Bush as it was, by President Clinton as it was, on and on and on. But not this president, because we don't like him. That's no longer the rule of law. So we ought to confront the policy disputes about how much immigration we ought to have, who ought to be making that judgment. It's Congress. And when they make that judgment, enforce the law so that the policy judgment they've made can actually be implemented rather than undermined by unfettered lawlessness or violation of the law. I mean, that's the real symbolic importance of the claims for a wall. What's going to be our immigration policy? Who does the Constitution assign the authority to make it? And are we going to continue to adhere to the rule of law once that policy judgment is set until we, the people, acting through our elected representatives, decide to change it? Thanks very much.
Very good.
Thank you, John.
Lee, do we have a few minutes to respond?
Yeah, quick responses. I got a lot of good questions. Yeah, go ahead, Reza.
I agree with most of the things you said, John, and that's the reason I mentioned, I think, you know, American people got to make a decision, you know, how much and what kind of immigrant. But I think I got to mention this, you know, I totally agree, and that's the reason I made this statement. As an immigrant, I have higher expectation, and I raised the bar for my friend from other countries. We come to this country. Nobody's pointing a gun at us to come to this country. People who come to this country, they come for a good reason. We want to be here. We like it here. And absolutely correct. We have to follow the law. Even if we don't like part of a culture, the language, I think we are a guest in this country, and we have to follow the rule, the custom, the culture. I'm Persian. When people come to my house, I have to ask them to take off their shoes, and they do it because as respect to my culture. But the problem here is not only Republican have a monopoly to make a bad decision or come up with a bad policy. The Democrats are as bad as the Republican. When come to making a decision, that might not be correct. Forgive me. Wasteful policy, a stupid policy. So I don't think, you know, it's important if this president made this bad statement, wrong statement, or another president. It doesn't matter. Same as our children. Why did you do this stupid thing? Because my older brother did the same thing. Or honestly, God, as an old professor, I was telling my colleague after teaching for 35 years, I tell my student, you got to come up with a creative nonsense or excuse. The one that I have not heard in the past 35 years. The kids tell me, well, I did this stupid thing because other students are doing the same thing. You know, that's not a good argument. So, and I'll be very honest with you, I tell all the immigrants, yes, absolutely, we got to follow the law. We got to implement American rules. But my question about the wall, is it really we want to reduce the number immigrant, undocumented, or this is a symbol we are using to play with American people's emotion? Is this a tool in my toolbox that I'm gonna use to be elected? I'm talking about myself, elected next time. So I don't want to be cynical, but I think, is it about the reducing the number of immigrants, or we have another purpose? I'm not sure about that. Thank you.
Do you want to respond? Should we go to questions?
I think that sort of there seem to be two questions, and one of them was who has the authority to make immigration decisions in this country, and the other is what should those decisions be, and sort of, you know, one is a question addressed to government, and one is a question addressed to the American public as it influences government, as it seeks to decide who will be its elected officials, as it tries to make a set of decisions. I also think that we should constantly return to the question of numbers and try to understand, while there's a frenzy over exactly how many people are trying to enter the country and who they are, what that is in the context of a broader American population, which is often far smaller than we imagine it to be. And if I take just as an example the migrant caravan that came in October that I covered, that made headline news for several weeks, we were talking about 8,000 to 10,000 people, the majority of which were asylum seekers, which is a fraction of the student population of this campus, who happened to be coming primarily to seek a legal route to the country. Legal in the sense that they have the right to seek asylum, and not in another sense, because people coming from those countries often do not have other means to come to this country. Immigration laws fluctuate in terms of who from different countries is deemed a worthy immigrant, and I think often, while there's a healthy discussion to be had about how to help immigrants arriving to this country, there's also a huge burden placed upon them to say you must be good actors in a way that is not placed upon the average American citizen. And I think that while we are having those conversations, we don't have a conversation about what are the wait times for a person from every single country who might be trying to come to the U.S. In some cases, it's 15, 20 years if you have a family member here and you are trying to figure out a way to come to this country. If you are you have a child in another country and you want that child to come here, 15 to 20 years is an unthinkable amount of time to wait. And we make distinctions between people who are deemed worthy because they might have a university education and a high school profession, whether they're engineers or whether they're doctors, and people who are doing equally as valuable labor, but it might be in farming, who are still incredibly valuable to this economy. And so while there isn't a system that, you know, sets an equal standard across the country and also a reasonable standard for how much time somebody must wait to go through a legal route, and there is a whole history of preference and discrimination and history put into those decisions of who is allowed to come through the quote-unquote legal routes, there is going to be a continued effort on the part of individuals to try to come to the country seeking a better life, as anyone will tell you, through whatever means possible. They may wish to take the legal route, but that route may not exist for them.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you. So there's a lot of... there's a pattern of questions here about what are the solutions and suggestions. I want to get to that in a second. There's also an interesting question about what about the northern border? Why is nobody talking about a wall with Canada? Because if Canada were to make their immigration laws lax, then there's a lot of mileage there that we would have to build a wall on as well. Or is it about skin color?
Yeah, so let me take that up. I mean, the reason there's so much focus on the southern border rather than northern border is not skin color. It's the southern border is where most of the illegal immigration is occurring. And I don't think anybody disputes that. Let me just give some show you how current we are on this panel, some numbers. In March, just reported this week by the Department of Homeland Security, 92,000 illegal border crossers were apprehended on our southern border. That's at a pace of over 1 million in a year. That's more than double just what it was a year ago and nearly four times what it was just 3 years ago. That's an extraordinary increase, and it's overwhelming the border security forces. Now, we may think that the number of legal immigrants and the process for obtaining legal immigration is not correct and urge Congress to try and fix it, but until it's changed, this is an evidence of lawlessness and illegality that no sovereign nation can long tolerate. All right, because if you can't control the borders with the policy mix that your assigned policymakers have settled on, then there's no such thing as a border. And that's not me saying that. That was Barbara Jordan in her report saying that some 25 years ago. You've got to be able to do that. Now, the other problem we've got are the asylum seekers. characters. Our statutes set out very precise criteria for who's eligible for asylum. And it's not anybody that wants to come to the United States to have a better life. As Maya pointed out earlier, it's, you know, you've got to show that you have a significant risk of being persecuted in your home country on specific criteria, religious or race or economic class or what have you. You don't just get to claim asylum because you want. And what we've seen is those that are released into the United States pending a future asylum hearing refuse to show up at their allotted asylum hearing about three quarters of the time. Of those that actually do show up, four out of every five, 80%, have their asylum claims rejected because it's patently obvious they weren't eligible for them. They're using the asylum claim as a way to get into this country in violation of our legal immigration routes. One other thing I want to point out, and this was, I was at a testified at a Civil Rights Commission hearing here in Boulder just a month ago. The demonization of the current administration on this. One of the issues was Trump has doubled the size of the legal immigration forms to make it more difficult for people to come here legally. And I kind of looked at that charge. Well, it was based on a Cato Institute study. The forms increase in size all occurred in December of 2016. Now, think about that for a moment. President Trump was elected in November of 2016, but he didn't take office until January 20th of 2017. That increased size in the forms that supposedly was evidence of the Trump administration's hostility even toward legal immigration had occurred on the prior watch. So we've got to peel back some of the onions of party animosity here to try and honestly assess what's going on and try and deal with it in a way, as Barbara Jordan said, that actually manages immigration so that it serves our national interest. That's what the policymakers in Congress ought to be looking at.
Good. So I think, you know, the difference between northern and border, the northern and southern border might not really connect it to the color of his skin. And yes, some Democrats probably are naysayers. No matter what this president say, they say no. And I think, unfortunately, the Democrat returning a favor because the Republican did the same thing with Obama administration. That's the reason, folks. It's painful for me as an immigrant who lives in this country to see a dysfunctional government. Nobody's going to win. We're all going to lose. But let me tell you this. When you are a leader of a free country, I think you have to watch what you say. You have to be very careful because you send an important message to the rest of the world. Here, I don't think I'm picking up on anybody. I'm just stating the fact. When a leader of a country, I don't want to be that specific, says, well, I don't want people from shithole countries, and I want people from Western Europe, what do you think I feel or how I'm going to react as not very well educated American living in a certain part of country, not in Boulder, maybe other areas? I don't know if there is a cause and effect. So it's not really cherry picking and trying to destroy somebody. But I'm saying we got to look at the way we talk to people, the way we make the statement, especially if you're in the position of power. I have to watch myself every single day when I walk in the classroom. I'm the role model. I got to set the stage. If I'm conscientious of what I say and what I do in the classroom, don't you think that's appropriate also for a real leader of a country that a lot of other nations, other people look up to them? That's just my humble opinion.
I just just want to respond to the specific set of questions about Canada and Mexico. One, the U.S. has an agreement with Canada, which is a safe third country agreement that says that if you're going through Canada, you're supposed to seek asylum first in Canada rather than in the U.S., which is an agreement that has been proposed to have with Mexico, but has never gone forward for many reasons. The other issue is that it's also possible for people to come to different countries in Latin America and then migrate north to countries that have more, let's say, generous visa policies that allow people to come and then make trips north, whether they're coming through Brazil, whether they're coming through Ecuador. And again, people who don't see another option. And so in many cases risk their lives passing through areas like the border of Panama and to do that in order to try to get to the U.S. Of the 92,000 people apprehended at the border, some 62,000 were families. And that's important because when you have, let's say, a parent with small children come to the country, that is not, again, someone who is trying to bypass the border patrol, but rather, again, someone who in most cases is seeking asylum. That's not to discredit the other 30,000 people who may also be seeking asylum, who are single adults, be they of any gender. So, again, when you have a system whereby people are seeking help, you have to take that into account. It's not the same as 10 years ago. And while we might say apprehensions are at the highest level that they've been in 12 years, 12 years ago you also had many more people who were just trying to bypass the border patrol, and you can debate whether that was good or not. But if we're looking specifically at asylum seekers, these are people who are coming and who may not know the intricacies of asylum law, but I would guess that the majority of you don't either, because it's very complicated, and are trying to figure out whether there is a way for them to stay. And in some cases, that means that they have been extorted and had guns pointed at their family and been told they have 24 hours to get out of the country. In some cases, that means that they are people from rural areas who are fleeing because they are in areas affected by climate change, and those people might not be people who are in the end approved in their asylum cases, but they have to go through a process. Because sometimes it is that they're living in areas with territorial disputes that put them at risk. Sometimes people come from abusive households where they've been living in those conditions for years, and yet they are still people who should be granted protections. Many people who come to the asylum system, yes, are not approved at the end of the asylum system, but the U.S. also has a history of making those decisions in part based off of its own political interests. When Salvadorans were fleeing the civil war in the 80s, the asylum approval rate for them was 1-2%, and you can argue perhaps that none of those were valid asylum seekers fleeing a civil war, and yet we know that the U.S. is much more sympathetic to people, say, fleeing communist governments with its own political interests. And so that has to be taken into account. The other is, do you have a lawyer? If you have a lawyer in the asylum system, if you have thousands of dollars to pay a lawyer, your chances of being approved are vastly, vastly higher. If you don't, you may have an invalid asylum claim. You may not be an English speaker. Probably you are not. You may not be a Spanish speaker. You may not be able to find the translation services you need to go through an asylum application. You may not be able to say, my particular social group is, a indigenous woman in Guatemala who is affected by discrimination for these specific reasons such that I should be granted asylum. And yet you may have a valid asylum claim. You may not. You may be someone who, as I said, is fleeing for economic reasons, is fleeing because of climate change, is fleeing because there's generalized violence in your country. And there's another debate to be had about whether those people deserve other sorts of protections that go beyond the existing asylum system. But the fact that someone would eventually lose their claim is not at all indicative of the fact that they don't have valid reasons reasons for trying to come, nor does it suggest that they are not in fact valid asylum seekers. And we have a process in place that says if you are going to enter the asylum system, we're going to give you a preliminary interview to determine whether you have credible fear. 75% of people pass that first interview, which may be an hour or 2 hours, in which they have to explain why they've come. And so there is a process in place to try to assess whether someone has some grounds to enter into this process. And so we cannot have a discussion about who the border crossers are, and we should not have a discussion that is focused exclusively on the language of illegal border crossers as though people were not crossing and in many cases seeking out the Border Patrol officials to hand themselves in. That is such a fundamental part of our landscape at this moment that you can't just take the numbers at face value and not talk about who the constituents are.
Thank you. Thank you. There's one good question I'm not going to have the panelists respond to, but how does a wall actually help? Won't building a 30-foot wall just create a high demand for 31-foot ladders? Thank you. That was good. A couple of questions
here. That person must be economist.
Yeah, that's right. Next one, quick answer from Maya, is about, you know, explaining the sudden surge of people at the border. Is that more because the situation is worse in Central America or because of the threat of the wall and people want to get in before the wall is constructed?
I'm waiting for the historians to answer this question in several years, right? We have some set of answers. Some of those answers are that conditions are still very bad in Central America. So Hondurans and Guatemalans are the majority of people coming. They are people who are coming from areas where there's a high degree of government corruption. There's a high degree of violence. Most crimes are never solved. Many people are living in extreme poverty. Many people will speak to the fact that they can't find stable jobs, that they are turned away. Often there's an intersection of those factors. If you are an 18 or 17-year-old coming from a particularly violent gang-controlled neighborhood in parts of Honduras, when you go to a factory to try to apply for a job, they'll look at where you live and often turn you away based off of where you're from. And we'll also see people who, again, might be farmers coming from agricultural regions where there's not as much yield, where all of a sudden they're finding that their crop yields are dwindling, where they're finding also that coffee prices have crashed, and they're not sure how to sustain themselves. That can intersect in other ways with territorial disputes, with people fighting over land, with people being threatened. Again, Central America has a large gang presence and also is an area through which there's a lot of drug smuggling as well. So, you know, I would say that some people are coming for many of these factors, and you can try to track, you know, how high is the homicide rate, how bad are some of these economic factors. I would also say, yes, there is a conversation being had as more people are becoming aware of things like the fact that they can hand themselves in with a child and enter an asylum system. Obviously, that is information that goes into someone's decision. So whether that's because you have a family member who has already gone through that process and is still having their cases adjudicated in court, or whether that is because, you know, in your town there are smugglers who tell you this is a good moment to go if you are going to risk all of your property here and, you know, put up your land or your house in order to try to pay for this, now would be the moment. Yeah, like that is part of the conversation that is going on. But again, these are people living in dire circumstances who have to make a choice about when might be the best moment to go.
But let me point out, none of those things that she just listed are grounds under American law for asylum. And what we have seen is a transition from single men coming in to try and get here legally, get a job and send money back home, to people coming with families. And why is that? Well, it's a consequence of another development in American law, dating back to the 1990s and the Flores decision that prohibits minor children from being kept in detention while their asylum claims are being processed. So they have to be released. Now, President Obama tried to create family detention centers so that the children and the parents could stay together and they asked the courts for a modification of the Flores settlement to allow that. The court rejected that in 2016, still on President Obama's watch. And then you're confronted with the do you release the children as well as the parents into the United States, knowing that the asylum claim is probably invalid, and knowing that they're not going to come for the hearing, which is essentially giving them carte blanche to enter the United States illegally, or do you keep the parents in detention and release the children? That caused the separating of families. But the word had gone out that if you bring a child, you're going to have this ticket into the United States because they're not going to separate you. And when President Trump tried to say, well, we're not going to play that game of chicken. If you come here illegally, we're going to keep you detained. The Flores decision forced the separation of the children. So this all of a sudden became a ticket to get in, and that's why we see this huge increase of people coming with children, whether they're their own children or children they've grabbed along the way so they can make these claims. And that's even a more... What's that? There are a lot of facts on that. The Department of Homeland Security has identified thousands of such children who came without people that were not related, with people that were not related to them. So if you want to be part of the panel, be happy to on the next year, but don't sit there in the front row and challenge me on facts that you don't know what you're talking about. I've got the exact fact from the Department of Homeland Security on that.
All right.
Okay.
Can I get to another? Okay.
I think it's, Siggy again, putting my professor hat, I think it's important for all of us to feel comfortable to express our feeling, our opinion, even if you're wrong. I think that's very important, because when I was growing up in Iran, I didn't have that luxury. So it's very important to express ourselves, and I think it's okay somebody provide us with facts to say it's wrong. So I don't want to say the truth is someplace in between, but the thing is, yes, we've got some people might break the law, but also as an economist, I want to look at the cost. When a lot of people are coming in, I don't want to say, look, we've got to accept them with the open arm. And I want to, if I have time, I want to tell you the story about my daughter. This happened many years ago when there was a riot in Paris and the refugees were burning the buildings and so on and so forth. I was driving my daughter to a soccer game, and I think she was probably 9 or 10 at that time. And we were listening public radio, and she said that people should have a freedom to live anywhere they want. And I told her, agree with that statement. So as an economic professor, I'm saying, look, what I'm supposed to tell my daughter? Then I said, what the heck is a teaching moment? You got to talk about the reality, talking fact, talk about the scarcity. I said, sweetheart, we cannot accept all the refugees, all other people want to come to our country and live here because we don't have the resources. So if you want to just make people feel good, you can tell them, look, come to our country. We accept you with open heart and open arm. But if you don't educate people, if you don't provide them with housing, if you don't create job, if you put them in the ghettos, they're going to act like animals. Forgive me, that's the thing. But one thing we got to do, we got to go to the source of a problem. Why those people are leaving their country? And you're absolutely correct. Environmental problem, crime, poverty, I totally understand. But what we got to do is, and the study shows, again, to give you some numbers, to give you fact, is not going to be sustainable because there are more and more people want to do the same thing. Now, the study shows it's 12 times much cheaper if we house those refugees, because we might not do it in their country because of all the crime, I totally understand, but maybe some of the safer surrounding countries. And I think that's one of the human solutions that we should use as a country, is to house them to the safest, nearest country, because 12 times is cheaper. Or as a country, as a United States, as a role model, to go to those Latin American countries, identify the source of a crime, I mean the poverty or whatever the problem is, and try to help them financially. This is much more cost effective. Again, I don't want to be accused on picking up on somebody, but the administration just threatened that they're going to reduce the foreign aid on those countries that they're sending a lot of the refugees. So I don't know about you guys, I'm a little bit confused. There are a lot of inconsistency. There are a lot of confusing message I'm getting when I watch the news from one day to another. And if you think we are confused as an American, what do you think other people, other countries are going to think about us and our foreign policy, immigration policy, on and on and on?
Thanks. We got a lot of good questions and only 7 minutes left. There's a lot of questions about how do our policies compare to other countries around asylum and stuff. How are other countries' border walls working? But I wanted to have the panelists talk about, people are asking for, what are the solutions? How do we manage the numbers? How do we determine what are the numbers of people that we can, that are the capacity, that's from a student, how many people we need? What would we do with money to manage the immigration issue? And what are some longer term bipartisan solutions?
Yeah, so, you know, and this goes back to my opening comments about how this has become a much more partisan fight than it used to be. The open borders crowd, according to Bernie Sanders in a 2015 interview, was the Koch brothers, a right-wing proposal which says essentially there should be no border because therefore no United States. That's shifted. The open borders crowd is largely on the other side, although there are crony capitalists on the Republican side of the aisle that want the cheap labor. The bigger problem, it goes back to this notion that we are the first time in human history, really, such a large border with relatively third world type economy next to a first world type economy with a large welfare state. The economic draw on that is going to be huge, as my friend here has pointed out. Now, there are two ways you can address that. Just open the borders no matter what the consequences in the United States are. Forget any notion of assimilation. Forget any notion on how much can we absorb in any given year. We still have, by far, almost more than all the rest of the world combined, the largest legal immigration into this country. How much more above that can it go without disrupting our own institutions? That should be the primary concern of American policymakers. But we are also a generous people, and we understand the poverty problems elsewhere in the world. How do you fix that? Do we go impose an economic and governmental system on them that we think is going to work better? That's not a very good solution. Do we just give them massive amounts of foreign aid if it's going to corrupt governments and not getting down to the people that need it? That's not a very good solution either. So none of those solutions really work. One of the things that our policy judgments ought to be looking at is what is necessary from an American perspective, because our policy judgments need to be putting first and foremost American interests, broadly understood, to be sure. But when you lose track of that, there are a billion people in the world that would like to come to the United States. Can we handle that next year? I mean, think about what it would mean. Right, it can't be done, and so at some point we have to make a balance assessment on our policy and then stick with it.
So maybe Reza 2 minutes and Maya 2 minutes and we're done.
Can I say something? I can be quiet.
You got.
Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, it's wonderful, you know, that a couple people can be here, you know, and disagree over the issue, you know, or a policy and call each other friend. I hope Republican and Democrat in Washington do the same thing, come together and honest to God, discuss some of these issues. They're going to be amazed how much are in their agreement. But, you know, if not really, if you say no and no, if you don't get together, we won't be able to solve the problem. Now, see, I agree. Put American interests first. So American interest is giving the fact, as I started at the beginning of my talk, that the fact that we are getting older is American interest. I have no problem using the following term, a skill-based bring people that our economy needs, the engineer, the scientist. But at the same time, folks, we need people in dairy farm to milk the cow. We need people, again, as I said, to clean our houses, to take care of yard, you know, take care of babies, you know. And again, I think I don't want to say that there is a disconnect here, you know, between American interest and immigration. I think those two are not mutually exclusive. And if we have a wise immigration policy, I think we're going to help this country a great deal. Unfortunately, sometimes our immigration is not based on logic. It's nilly-willy. And this is what this is the last example I use. This is a personal issue for me. You guys heard about travel ban on majority Muslim country. I have one child, and you know what are the greatest moments for the parents when their child graduate or would get married? None of my family from Iran were able to come for my daughter's wedding, and that's very painful for me. But this is what I'm saying. Again, I'm saddened. I'm not resentment, but I don't mind if somebody give me a reason. It's a reason. There is a travel ban against Iranian because you have done bad to American. Have you heard any Persian or any Iranian has committed anything, I mean, simple stuff, but really bad things that Iranian people, and some of them are not even Muslim. Some of them are not even Muslim, believe it or not. So who has committed more crime in this country? People from Iran, forgive me, I don't want to be mean, or people from Saudi Arabia. So that's what I'm saying. Immigration decisions should be based on logic. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, Maya, you got 1 minute to solve U.S. immigration policies. Go.
First, I would say that I think having a conversation only about America and American policy is limited and isolated because we're at a moment where we have more displaced people than perhaps ever before, and that's not going to change. It's not like we're going to wake up tomorrow and people will say, there's no globalization. I'm going to live at home. My country has no problems. And so if we were really to be forward-thinking, we would have a conversation about how it is that we're going to facilitate mobility internationally, right? Is there a UN system that would allow people to relocate? Is there a system that would allow more than 1 or 2% of refugees to actually go to another country through a legal route? Since that's the terms that we're talking about right now. If you are a refugee, you have almost no resources available to you to help you to get out. And so while we're sitting here having a conversation about how many billion dollars we might spend on a few miles of the U.S. border, I think we are forgetting the entire conversation about what is going to happen in a collaborative fashion between countries in the world to address the fact that people are going to continue to move. And while we're doing that, we can have a conversation then about what are the needs of American cities and what are the needs of rural America. That's an important part of the conversation. And we know, as was pointed out demographically, that we're going to need more immigration, but we're having a conversation about the limits of immigration, about whether we've already reached a breaking point when we have not, and we have a lot of rhetoric based around this idea of a crisis and a breaking point, when there are easy fixes to the short term, like designating more immigration judges, like creating a more humane asylum system that thankfully at this point doesn't involve detaining children past 20 days, but really has far, far to go to be humane. People who are released from detention get out with an ankle monitor, as though they were animals that had to be tracked, or they have to pay thousands of dollars to be released on bond. There are people who die in detention. There are people who commit suicide in detention. There are children who have died in detention from infectious diseases. It's not an easy thing to do to get up with a backpack and cross several countries and make an attempt to enter another country and live there and reestablish yourself there and tell your children that it's going to be fine and put them into schools knowing that you might lose your asylum case. You probably will, and if you can't come up with the money for a lawyer, especially in certain states where your judge is unlikely to approve you, you're just going to be sent back to where you came from, and you might be back in the same gang-controlled, impoverished neighborhood that you just tried to leave, but thousands of dollars more in debt. That's not an easy decision to make. And so, yes, we can have a conversation about aid as well. Aid, as it currently stands, doesn't go directly to corrupt governments. There's a whole other system of distribution that is in place to prevent that from happening. Certainly, cutting it off altogether is not that helpful. Some of the programs are well-functioning. Some of the programs are giving people opportunities to work in jobs that they might not otherwise be trained for if they are 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and otherwise would just become involved in local crime, in other issues, would be finding no unemployment and would be forced to migrate again. There are conversations to be had about how to make that aid better, about how to have conversations with people who actually live in those countries about what they need, and not to have aid be imposed and not to have it be just another tool of like American diplomatic power, which it can very easily be. And so yes, we have to address the problems in the places where people are coming from. But to treat immigration always as a problem, to treat people who are asylum seekers who may not know the rules of this system as people who are constantly breaking the law, who have to be held, be it in refugee camps outside of the country, as was somewhat the intention of the Remain in Mexico policy implemented under this administration, which said, wait in Mexico, good luck. Sorry if some of you have been kidnapped, assaulted, or robbed while you were waiting, but this is not our responsibility at the moment. That's why the courts have temporarily blocked it. We'll see what happens with that. That is a proposal on the table, but it's a proposal based on the idea that this shouldn't be our problem. Let it be the problem of Mexico. Let it be the problem of Canada. And then there's a repeated refrain to countries in Central America, fix your own problems, prevent your own people from leaving, when in some cases people are fleeing their own governments. So it's particularly backwards to turn to a government and say, block your people from leaving, sorry that they are struggling from persecution. And then it's a particular problem when the U.S. has a history of intervening in those countries in particularly bad ways, of interfering in their elections, their governments, and also to have an immigration system that perpetuates those problems. Where did the gangs in Central America come from? They originated in the United States. The U.S.'s response was, these people are criminals. These people are immigrants. We have the right to kick them out. And where did they send them? To Central America. That's what happens when you have an immigration system that does not have integration, that does not have education, that is based off of a system of limits and prohibitions, as opposed to a systematic way of trying to expand the number of people who are coming.
What happened? That's the longest one-minute closing I've ever heard.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you. All right, we got to wrap up. Just kind of summarize some of, there was a lot of other questions we didn't get to, but as we can see, this is a very complex issue that's full of emotions. There was a lot of people questioning some of the facts that came up here, some of the facts out there, about politics, about international policies, about the economics of it. So I want to thank our panelists for being here. Thank you all for being a part of this conversation.